Welcome to Right Here in Mass. We're a weekly podcast that features individuals throughout the Bay State who are on our radar and should be on yours. From the Berkshires to Boston, Cape Cod and the islands, tune in to learn about who you should know right here in Mass. Welcome back to another episode of Right Here in Mass. Joining me today is Jonathan Garland, president and founder of JGE Architecture and Design. Jonathan has over 20 years of professional experience planning and designing residential, mixed-use, academic, and institutional projects. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashley. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I am glad to have you here, especially because I'm really excited to hear more about what you do within architecture and design. And so for our listeners, your full bio will be in the show notes, but I'd love to start off by giving you the opportunity to share more about what you do and who you are.
Sure. Thanks for the time. So yes, I'm Jonathan Garland, president, founder of, in fact, two companies, JGE Architecture and Design and JGE Development. They're both minority-owned practices based right here in the city of Boston, the city I grew up in the city that I absolutely love. It's a place where we really see the convergence of public policy and design and community voice coming together. Most of our work is affordable housing in and around the city of Boston. And I think what we try to do as architects and designers is build upon what we think to be a social responsibility to help solve the housing crisis. We see too many, too often, folks coming to the state, to the region for high class, high quality education, and then moving on because they can't find that affordable housing. So that's one of the core pieces of our mission and our focus.
Yeah, I think you nailed it because like you said, it's people are kind of stuck either in like the long-term rental space of just having to rent a home because they can't afford a mortgage or like you said, having to move out of the city. And so I'm glad that you brought up that point about having affordable housing as really your core value and mission and what's important to you. And so could you talk more about that and kind of how you got started within that sector ultimately and led you to where you are today?
Yeah, a lot of it is the neighborhoods I grew up in, you know, seeing whether it's parts of Hyde Park, parts of, you know, Brighton, you know, areas, Dorchester, Roxbury, areas like that. Just wanting to provide equity, you know, is the main goal and wanting to make sure that people have quality of life. I really love the fact that legislation has been passed around energy and the new adds to the building code where things like passive house are now going to be incorporated into the affordable housing space. That's really going to provide long lasting building envelopes and spaces that people can enjoy. And just because you're coming up in life doesn't mean that you should be given second class housing. And so it really is part of our mission to kind of make sure that people have the same quality of life and that it's not, it doesn't just stop at the housing. There's also other measures like childcare, you know, transportation, affordable and accessible transportation, spaces that are humanly accessible, making sure that, you know, there's a ground floor entry that can function well, that daylight, you know, pours into the space. So we really look at the architectural response to neighborhoods, whether it's density scale, but we also look at the bottom line pieces of the form and the function to make sure that people do feel that they've been acknowledged in the process.
Absolutely. And so with both of your companies, the architecture and development, of course, they go hand in hand. Did you start them both at the same time or did one come before the other?
So formally, they did stagger a bit. The original vision was to launch them together. But as businesses, sometimes one picks up faster than the other. And so we really did lean into the architecture piece from a business side that does have more of an operational aspect to it. You know, you need real estate, you need a place to house your staff, you need staff. You know, you need a certain breadth of work to kind of really get the architectural engine moving. And so we did lean into that. And that's where, honestly, where my most of my professional training and background is from. So we found ourselves garnering a lot more architectural work before development work came in. But now, presently, we're pleased to be able to talk about three of our real estate development projects where JGE is participating as a co-developer with other affordable housing developers in the city of Boston. And it's really great when the two companies can work together. There are two projects where we have a design role as well as a development role. And that not only helps me personally to be a better advocate for what we do, but it really helps our design staff understand the other side of how these projects work and what are some of the economic drivers. It's not always about aesthetic design, it's also about design that can be afforded and constructed.
Absolutely. And so you mentioned three projects that are coming up. Could you talk more about what those are?
I can talk about two of them. I can't talk about all three for confidentiality reasons, but so one is in the Mission Hill neighborhood. It's a beautiful project and concept. It's over a 30, it manages a 30-foot grade change between a low end of the site and a high end of the site. So we're essentially building into a hill. And it's with two of my closest colleagues in this industry, Kevin McGuire of Oxbow Urban and Dariella Villamaga of DVM Partners. And so together, the three of us have conceptualized. We went through a City of Boston RFP process, and we've conceptualized 48 affordable homeownership units. These would mostly be for first-time home buyers that are trying to begin their wealth creation, wealth generation journey for the long term. And so this will be a mix of everything from studio to three-bedroom units, passive house construction, structured parking, lobby and amenity space, and an open space on the site, both a community garden as well as another kind of open space. And so we're really excited for that one. A second one, a bit larger, is with the Planning Office of Urban Affairs as our development partner. And we're working on the edge of the Nubian Square neighborhood, Tremont Street, Melnia Cass Boulevard, that area of Boston, and it will be 217 units of housing, which will be a mix of both affordable homeownership and affordable rental units, a smaller portion of market rate housing. Really happy to be able to talk about our partnership with the St. Catherine Drexel Parish, who really, in many ways, has made this project possible. We are working closely with them. They have a host of programs, a food pantry. There will be an affordable childcare that's been a longstanding relationship with ABCD and the parish. We're doing a multi-generational open space over an acre and a half. We're preserving mature trees. It's a phenomenal program. And to me, it's housing plus. It's more than just housing. It really is a community development.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought up the childcare point because, like you mentioned, that is a really big challenge with affordability and working parents being able to find that. And so I think it's wonderful that that program has that incorporated with it. And it just is a testament to showing that you're listening to and meeting the needs of people within this area and being able to provide a solution for them.
And Ashley, that comes by getting out and talking to people. That's really how you learn what's important, and you can take that those comments to heart, because it's one thing to help people pay a lower mortgage or a lower, rent amount, but it's another thing if they have to take that same pot of money and go give it to expensive childcare. So if we can think about affordable ways of creating accessible transportation. This is right across the street from Ruggles train station that puts you on queue with rapid transit, as well as commuter rail, as well as bus line. So we think about location, multimodal transportation options, as well as childcare and qualitative open space. You really have to look at the full life cycle of the individual and what is a day in the life for them, and how are some of these resources available and accessible to them.
Definitely. And you also mentioned working with a few different partners. You mentioned your two really good colleagues in the industry. And I think it's, like you said, really important to have those other companies or other partners who can help you bring a project to life. And so I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit more in terms of the importance of having those close relationships.
Relationships are key. I'm sure you've heard many times, it's not always what you know, it's who you know. And so
Yes.
that definitely plays out here. I have deep respect for the partners that we work with. They come with a lot of knowledge, a lot of experience, units that have been not only constructed, but either fully leased or fully sold. So we really try to surround ourselves with what I think to be industry experts or thought leaders or people that really understand the space, but they also come with a creative side. And not every deal is the same, especially in the city of Boston. You have to think creatively when you're going through public permitting, entitlements, managing the community process efficiently. But it's also about a shared mission and a shared set of values. That's really what keeps the formation of teamwork together, is if you can understand that there's a deeper goal here. It's not just to be able to provide housing and collect a profit, if that's what your goal is. The goal is to be able to help solve this crisis that we're in, where people are being priced out of the city, or they can't even get in. They can't even get into the city to begin with, whether you're coming from college and trying to stick around, whether you've lived in the neighborhood for a while and you'd like to transition from rental housing to buying something and owning something. So we see ourselves as, being on the front line of helping to solve that. And when we can partner with people that share that vision, it makes the process worthwhile.
That's such an important point that you brought up because that's one thing that I feel like the community I'm in down on the South Coast struggles with is that there's so much development going on. And so a lot of residents are always like, well, here's more apartments going up and here's more houses going up. And sometimes it might come across as this housing is just coming up, just like you said, just to make a profit. But you brought up a really important point about being able to provide that solution, of being able to take the problem of affordable housing and provide a solution for it with the projects that you have going on. So really working to support people during this challenge that they're going through, rather than looking at it from the profit side, if that makes sense.
Right. And even community benefits. Oftentimes, or too often, developers come in with a list of almost like pick your own community benefit, right? Preconceived benefits. I'm adamantly against that. I really think benefits for different communities are inherently different. We've talked to constituents, and sometimes they say, look, we'd love if you could start a fund, a college preparation fund for the youth in our area. We'd love if you were able to dedicate a room at the base of your building, at the ground floor of your building, for some computer space and some homework help, so that my kids are off the street, after school, and they have a safe place to kind of do homework. So every community is different. Every neighborhood needs something different. And so, as you're thinking about development and the flow of capital going through the development, there are opportunities to create meaningful benefits. But again, that requires conversation. As a developer, as a designer, whatever it might be, you can't come into it with that idea.
Yeah, and what you mentioned, Jonathan, I think is, like you said, really important. I mean, and I think that's a great idea what you said some of the residents or community members brought up about looking for a scholarship or looking or a college fund or looking for a room where there's youth or whoever could be able to use it. And so I think that's a really unique point that you're bringing in or something that you're doing that's different from what other people might be doing.
Yeah, and again, the reason why it's different is because the idea didn't come from me. It comes
Yeah.
from the constituents. That's the beauty of it. Even right now, on one of our projects, we're planning the amenity space in the building. So instead of us, the internal designer, developer, planning the amenity space, we invited our property manager to the table. And we said, hey, you folks are in touch with the residents on a daily basis. You folks are collecting the complaints about, if the building is too noisy, if there's, issues happening outside in the neighborhood, whatever the issues are, all the good, all the bad, you guys are the frontline folks engaging with the actual residents. What types of amenities do you think residents care about? What types of things are popular? What, is work from home, is sort of like flexible space, is that still a thing? Is that popular? Is access to outdoor space popular? Are media rooms popular? Like, what do you think as the, so our job, I think, in many ways, is to just try to have the right conversations. Because if we can do that, then we're coming with relevant and useful information to put into these developments.
Absolutely. And I love the full circle moment that you've had of growing up in Boston and now being able to develop in the city too. And so I'm curious to hear why or what makes Boston such a great location for you, like why you think it's such a great place to be able to focus on bringing affordable housing and really being able to have these great projects come to life.
That is a great question. I can't answer that without smiling. It's Boston to me has so many layers. You can experience the history as well as this idea of forward-looking, modern, and all in one place. And there's a beautiful dichotomy between what it means to preserve the history as well as lead the country in many ways on the next generation of living. And I don't just mean living in housing, I mean living within the built community. So as you think about efforts to decarbonize our city, as you think about efforts to mitigate against sea level rise, in many ways, Boston and Massachusetts is a think tank for the rest of the country. And I absolutely love that dichotomy between understanding what the science and the building engineering that goes into preserving some of our most cherished historical assets, as well as cutting edge, whether it's cross-laminated timber construction, mixed with passive house, mixed with net zero carbon. There's so many layers, and we are always pushing the envelope with policy. We're always thinking about the next, thing to do with transportation, an emphasis on bikes, modality versus vehicles. And so I don't know if I would experience that anywhere else in the country. And maybe I would, but I'm selfish in that way. I love my Celtics. I love my Patriots. I love my Red Sox. I just there's so much about the culture, the city, the access to the waterfront. I mean, I've traveled. I'm pretty well traveled, pretty well cultured, but I always come back here.
Yeah, love that dirty water, right?
Yes, that too.
You brought up a really interesting point about that balance of preserving the historical piece, but also, like you said, being able to kind of focus on the innovation, whether it's sustainability or you mentioned the decarbonization of the city. And so I imagine that balancing that likely has led to some unique challenges of like having to fit certain regulations around historical buildings, but also trying to kind of, like you said, push the envelope a little bit more. And so I'm curious to hear maybe your process for how you've been able to do that, or maybe even some examples.
Sure. So one unique project we're doing now with a partner out in Colorado is the Animal Rescue League here in the city of Boston. It's an interesting project. We don't really market that we do animal rescue shelters, but it came about because of our prior work in the South End. This project happens to be in the South End, so inherently anything you build of scale in the South End, you need to go through the South End Landmark District Commission, which through our work on Columbus Ave, we have a very, very good relationship with them. And we understand their process, and I think we have a shared respect for what each other does. But right then and there is a challenge where we're building a building that will come online in the next few years. It will go into construction this year. And so it's got to meet the latest and greatest building code, the latest and greatest in terms of energy, which means, and it also has elements not unlike a hospital, because it does have to manage animal care 24/7. So you have large mechanical equipment to manage, the exchange of air coming in and out. And so how do you deal with, say, the roofscape of that building, which would ordinarily have large pieces of mechanical equipment within a historic district? That really puts a limitation on what you can see above the roof plane. Normally, if you go down the South End, you'll see beautiful Victorian era district buildings. You won't normally see buildings with big chiller plants on the top of the roofs. And so how do we kind of mix those two worlds together to create qualitative, acceptable design that can go through that rigorous permitting process efficiently while also not sacrificing the functional needs of the facility? And so that's a
Yeah.
really exciting project for us. We're looking forward to getting it off the ground. It's been a phenomenal client and project team. Animal Arts is our partner architect. They've been great to work with. And that's just one more example of merging the old with the new. And you kind of, if you're working in the city, you kind of have to fall in love with that challenge. Otherwise, it's going to annoy you. You know, you have to really love the struggle. And I haven't even mentioned the political piece, the community piece. There's
Right.
so many layers that go into doing good work in the city, but you kind of have to love the exercise of arm wrestling it every day. That's just part of the process.
Yeah, and I can imagine that that part probably makes it interesting too, because you probably have to get creative with certain
Absolutely.
solutions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And of course, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that you focus on a variety of different projects from the residential, mixed use, academic, and institutional. Do you have a favorite type, or you kind of enjoy doing all of them equally?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't really have a favorite type of building because buildings are not what I relate to or relate with. I relate to people. Okay, I talk to people, I understand. So, in many ways, I like to think of architecture as a vehicle to develop better and stronger and newer relationships with people. I enjoy all of our projects and all of our clients. I don't have a favorite typology. Our approach here has been responsive architecture, which means, you know, we don't just take a design that's been prefabricated in some vacuum and plop it on a site and hope that it works. We look at the site, we examine the neighborhood, we talk to the constituents, we understand what their values are. We want to know the potency of what they don't like as well as the potency of what they do like, and really come with a response to that, come with a responsive architecture that can build on the roots that are already in the neighborhood to kind of better infuse and better integrate the new building within the existing context. And that's why many times our first meeting or first series of meetings are listening sessions. We just want to show up and listen. We don't, you know, we'll draw in a minute, we'll draw later, but we want to show up and listen and get a sense of what the agendas are and understand the proper response to that. I've enjoyed our work at Williams College, you know, doing a multicultural center with the Davis Center. Phenomenal project, phenomenal client, phenomenal, you know, collaborator with Lear's Weintraub. And I've also enjoyed, you know, work at Roxbury Prep High School, which is going up under construction now. And it's exciting. Any project, whether it's housing or schools or mixed use or academic. To me and to us, it's really about the people and the communities that we get to engage with.
I love that. And having your two businesses, the development and the architecture, I'm curious to hear how you balance both of them. Like I said earlier, since they go hand in hand, I'm sure that really helps. But how do you kind of manage your time between the two?
Great question. Yeah, so I come at it with a real strong kind of understanding of the strategic approach of my personal bandwidth. For the most part, the development side is managed day to day by me. And so oftentimes, or most, what I've been doing is co-developing. So I like to develop with a partner because with that comes the opportunity to kind of understand that the project management of the deal can be shared in some ways. There's responsibilities and roles that can be broken down amongst us as a party, not as one individual. Because if you're not managing the deal on a daily basis, a lot of things can happen. So you want to make sure that you're not overloading yourself with that singular role of project management. And so by co-developing and by making sure there's a shared mission in terms of what we're doing, I found the ability to be able to manage that. But saying that, there is a limitation to how many development projects I'd like to take on at one time. So, like I said, right now we're involved in three. That feels pretty much like a full plate for me because with our current staff, we're hovering between 15 and 18 people here and there. And so that's a lot to manage on the architectural side. And we're sort of seeing how projects are are coming in the door, even with a volatile economy. So I want to make sure that we don't bite off more than we can chew. So I try to
Right.
keep the development to a co-developer model and work within 2 to 3 projects at any given time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm curious to hear about your, I'd say, why for joining the industry. Like, what was it that inspired you to become an architect and developer in that sense?
Yeah, so ever since I was 8 years old, I can remember vividly being in the back seat of my dad's Lincoln Town Car. You know, he's driving wherever, and I just have my whole head and neck out the window, looking at all these buildings, quite mesmerized at the jumping of scale, you know, between coming from a city to a suburban environment to a rural environment, that transitional scale. To being downtown where, you know, it's hard to find sunlight and you're just covered in shadows of buildings. And then also seeing kind of the usership of these buildings and how people rely on, you know, it's phenomenal numbers. It's something like people spend 90 plus percent of their life inside a building. So the immense amount of reliance that the human race has on being sheltered by a building, I always found phenomenal. And I always thought, how can I be a part of that? To me, that's a big piece of reliance of culture globally, people being inside of a building, you know, sheltered from the weather. And so I always thought that that was interesting. And I always was into art. I was always into painting, watercolor, you know, but I did think that I had a future in fine arts. So I wanted to pair my artistic passion with more of a purposeful passion. And that's how kind of architecture came to be for me ever since a young age, like I said, about 8 years old, and it just grew on that passion. And then in high school, I was privileged to go to a vocational high school where I was able to take architectural drafting in my 9th through 12th grade years. My grades were good enough in junior and senior year that I was able to work every other week at an architectural firm. Instead of going to school. So I would sort of do school, math, science, English, and then I would go to work and it would alternate every week. So that was really fun. And that kind of gave me a leg up on the industry where when I went to the Boston Architectural College, I had already in high school sat in on zoning hearings. I had already, you know, done drawings at a professional level. I sort of knew a lot of the terminology. I was starting to get a sense of the players. And by starting to know people and grow my network and grow my experience factor, I've always been a really kind of hands-on vocational learner. I'm not the type you want to sit in front of a chalkboard or a whiteboard. I really want to kind of get my hands in it. And that's followed me even to where I am today. And so it's just finding a way to make sure that that passion within me is being fed. And the work I do, I absolutely love it. And I think that's the key. It's like, you know, you find out what you love to do and then figure out how to get paid for it.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice. And I love that story. I mean, to know since you were 8 years old what you wanted to do, like, imagine if your 8-year-old self would know where you are now. That's kind of incredible to think about.
I know and I still run into people now. One of my buddies is actually current city councilor of Boston, District 4, Brian Worrell. And him and I remember playing basketball in my dad's driveway, or my parents' driveway. And I won't get into the rest of the story, but it was kind of fun. And to see him all the way till now, every time I talk to him, he's like, I can't believe that you stuck with this architectural profession. Because he knew me way back when.
I know, that's so funny, and I love that. And you brought up a good point too about finding what you love and then being able to make money from it, then finding a way to make money from it. For anyone listening to this episode who might be interested in pursuing like the architectural and development space, what advice would you have for them with getting started?
Yeah, so number one, it's not about math. Almost everybody I talk to says, with architecture, you have to be good at math. I'm here to say that's not what it's about. It's not about math. It's also not about being the one that gets showcased and celebrated all around for coming up with the fanciest building. Architecture and development is about being a good communicator, being a good mediator, and really understanding and listening to people. because within both of those worlds, design and development, you're going to be hit with so many decisions to make, so many choices, so many competing choices, so many very good, choices. It's not like one is easily good and one is easily bad. They're both going to be very, very good choices. And so the more you can get into the habit of communicating with people, understanding how to decipher information, listening to the tone and how it was said, and coming back, learning that, listening to that, and then coming back and presenting something that is palatable, that's what's going to make you an effective, curator in this built environment. Because with anything, there's 100 ways to do it. And so your job is to figure out the right way for that project. And that really comes through experience building and communicating.
Absolutely. And having grown up in Boston, I'm sure that you have many favorite local businesses that you've loved to support. And so I'm curious to hear what those might be.
All the ones at the Boston Public Market, I typically love. I make it a casual lunch spot almost on a weekly basis, and it's always something new, something exciting there. And kudos to everyone at the Boston Public Market. They're doing great work. And also, Shea Butter Smoothies is a local establishment I encourage everyone to try. It's delicious, it's nutritional, and it's run by a Black woman who owns it. And I'm always proud to support local entrepreneurs in the community.
Love that. Jonathan, this has been a really great episode, and I've appreciated having you come on the show. And I would now love to give you the opportunity to share with our listeners where they can find you online in case they'd like to reach out.
Sure, Ashley. So reach out to us at www.jgarlandenterprises.com. You will see our work on our website. You'll see our phenomenal staff that's behind it all. You'll get a read up on our two companies, and feel free to reach out anytime at that website. You'll find my email, jgarland@jgarlandenterprises.com.
Perfect. And I will link to all of those places in the show notes that our listeners can easily connect with you from there. But thank you so much again for coming on today's show.
Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Right Here in Mass. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed recording it. Be sure to subscribe, leave a review, follow us on social media, and share our podcast with your network. See you next week.